Session number 27074, Reel 18.
Gordon Lila Bambamba, Reel 18.
At a date which I can't give you at the moment, the Auxiliary Air Force was called up, mobilised for 6 months. And as I was still unmarried, I thought, well, it looks as if I should have stayed in the Air Force anyway. So through some contacts, I made an approach to Air Ministry and was offered a permanent commission. And so then I ended up a CO of 610 Squadron as a regular. But after the call-up period back at Houghton Park, again, I can't give you exact times or dates, someone called Chas Dorra, who I'd known for many years, who was coming, he'd been at Veterinary College at Edinburgh, he moved down to Chester, and it was decided to go back to an auxiliary squadron commander rather than the regular one, and I was posted to the intelligence branch of Air Ministry in what they call DDI-3. And I didn't know what really the job was going to involve. I didn't know it was going to probably be the most interesting job I would have in my lifetime. When I got to DDI-3, it was very top secret, because the brief of DDI-3 was the order of battle of the Russian, Chinese, South Korean, and other potentially enemy air forces. They also kept a little watch on the French and the Germans, etc. But that wasn't top secret. Before you could enter DDI-3, you had to be what you call positively vetted. Various people in various stages of your life were approached to ask, answer questions about you. And obviously, I got through that and was called positively vetted. But to enter DDI-3, there was a guard on the door, and you had to be recognised. And I can't remember how or whether I assume we had to identify, or he recognised you personally, and then you went in there. Now, in there, there were a number of offices, some with two or three people in. But intelligence is always based on a need to know. And so if you didn't need to know, nobody told you. And that's just one of the problems of intelligence, is it becomes so secret. And the reason for that is normally protecting the source, who could be a human being, get someone killed or shot. So intelligence community is very protective of the information. But it's no use having this information, a bit like what's happened over the Iraqi war, unless you let people know they can use the information about it. But anyway, I moved into this new world of intelligence. And my brief, and I was fortunate in this respect, because it was a new brief, was the order of battle of the Chinese Air Force and the Korean Air Force taking part in the Korean War. This originally, it was nothing to do, I had nothing to do with the Russian Air Force. But as the Russian Air Force came in more and more, they moved into what I call my area of territory. And frequently, the commanding officers were Russians, in the Chinese squadrons. So in the end, though under the system you'd have thought, I don't need to know anything about the Russian, in the end, of course, I need to know about the Russian Air Force. I didn't study the Russian Air Force in Europe, only the Russian Air Force in the Far East. Now, why I say it was interesting is, first of all, the sources of information. The biggest source of information is one which at that time was really top secret, and it always had a code number or code name with it, and it was due with signal intelligence. In my day, no one except who was positively vested knew of the existence of GCHQ. Now it, of course, is common knowledge, GCHQ, but no one knew of its existence. And signaling intelligence was the basic and backbone of what we knew, certainly say, about this. I'll stay with the Chinese Air Force just for a moment, of the Chinese Air Force. But there were other sources, refugees out of China. Then the huge Chinese community, as we all know, living in America and elsewhere, but particularly America, well, they corresponded with their relatives in China. And oddly enough, some of their relatives in China joined the Chinese Air Force. And all their mail was scanned in Hong Kong. And I suppose I shouldn't say that now. I suppose it's still top secret now. Anyway, so that was another source. Then there was odd people coming out, like priests or vicars, you know, who'd work in there as missionaries, and they were being forced out. And then there were escapees swimming from the mainland to Hong Kong. And so you've got... Now then, they didn't all come out with a load of information, but you built up a picture, and you know what, let's say, I'll take Canton because that was near Hong Kong, that there was an Air Force unit there, or more than one Air Force unit there. And then you get information from a letter that had been addressed to someone at unit so-and-so there. So you got a unit number. You couldn't pin it on anything yet, you see. Then, and I'm making this up now just to give you a picture, SIGINT had picked something up of someone using that number, landing an airplane. And then something had come up that it was a MiG 15 or whatever the MiGs were at that time, MiG 15. Then you'd visit GCHQ, which I say was completely, and you'd meet some of the people working there. And there were, some of the characters were unbelievable. I would remember one gentleman, I won't give you his name, but he was fluent in Russian, fluent in Chinese, fluent in Korean, or fluent enough in Korean. But the thing is, his main thing was he's a mathematician. You know, they're unbelievable characters you met there. And, but they listened to these signals, or other people listened to it, and then they analysed it. And they'd come up with two numbers. Let's say 12 and 14. And then somewhere in what you call it, Mokdun is his old name, what's it called now in Manchuria. Anyway, they come up with two numbers that appeared quite a number. And then again, through Sigint, you'd pick up that they were associated with aircraft. And eventually you tie them down to a sort of, I was at the time, it was MiGs, that's all I was interested in. You tie them down to MiGs. But there was a number missing. So we got a whole this group of these numbers with one missing in the end. And then you would pick up from some other odd channel the missing number from the centre. And again, over a period of time, a MiG-15 would come up with that number. So what you knew immediately then, you had all these pairs of MiG-15 squadrons. So you knew what the expansion of the China Air Force was going to be. It was going to increase by a third in X period. So you not only knew its strength, its order of battle, you knew what it was growing into. Then you also got an idea of its skills. Because listening then to one more simple thing is, the pilots training in Canton, you'd hear them being talked down. It's quite simple things. Turn left, turn right sort of thing. In other words, you knew they weren't very competent. So you knew how their training was going on and how good. And then that unit would move somewhere. It picked up and you knew they were going to take part in the war. You thought, well, good God, those people are not very good. And so there was that side of it, all that feed of information and dealing with GCHQ, which I loved. It was tremendous dealing with those people. But then at the other side of it, it was people who wanted to know the information. And you got to brief and see, meet all sorts of people. For instance, someone would turn up, I remember one, someone I knew, Frankie Banner, very well. And I don't know where he came from, I don't know where he went. But he gave me a whole lot of information about the Chinese Air Force. But I didn't know where he came from, anything about it. And that's how it was. But I always remember, his name wasn't Ramsay MacDonald, someone called MacDonald. He was High Commissioner for the Far East. He was going out to be High Commissioner for the Far East. We had this very top secret room. We drew the curtains back. And I started pointing out to him where the Chinese and the Russian Air Forces were. Now remember, he was cleared for top secret things. He says, I don't want to know. I don't want to hold this in mind. I don't want to be troubled with this. Stop your briefing. Though he's going about, he'd be in charge out there. He didn't want to be loaded that he had that information. So you met people like that. And see, the other thing interesting, intelligence starts from the bottom, not from the top. Most organizations, information comes from the top. In intelligence, everything comes up from the bottom. So I got a cabinet file on my desk, signed WCC, I think I had Churchill signed his name. And in this file was written Y by Churchill. And in our briefings to the cabinet office, let's say I'd said that there were 400 MiGs 15s in Manchuria, North Korea. What number did I say then?
400.
400. The air secretary in America, whatever his title was, had just told Congress he wanted to increase the Air Force strength by so many amounts because there was 500 or 600 MiG-15s in Manchuria. And Churchill wanted to know why. You know, difference of 200 MiGs, what was it all about? So I get onto my opposite number in the Pentagon on telex, he used then. And the answer eventually came back after him. But again, it was called confidential, obviously, the air secretary over there wanted to increase the strength of the Air Force over there, because that was their policy. They believed that, you know, the Russians coming in and that, they needed it. And the only way they were going to get it through Congress was by to increase the number of others. And so that's why they put up the bigger number, because we used to compare notes with the Americans all the time. We were like this with our intelligence. Shared everything. So that's why that sort of information. But see, the sort of people. Now, that information then went up the line to my boss and so much, you see, who then probably briefed someone in the cabinet, who then briefed Churchill. But I say that's the difference with intelligence. It does come from the bottom, which makes it fascinating. Now, the other thing which I did there was my last thing, and whether it's in existence now, no one had produced a history up to that stage of the Chinese Air Force. They'd done it of the Russian Air Force. So I wrote the first history of the Chinese Air Force while I was there. What their training was like, and every aspect of what units they have, where they were based, their capabilities, and everything.
With this sort of information, you know, you did draw a picture in there of how you could work out the capabilities of each pilot. How did you find out information about their training?
Well, mainly from SIGINT. What they said, landing in an airfield, talking in an airfield, you see. You know, someone saying, you're coming in too high, you're coming in too low, or telling them something that in our Air Force the pilot would have known to do. They were being told over the... So their training was very basic, that sort of thing. But then they were in another department. We had a department who just studied the training of the Russian Air Force and the Chinese Air Force. So when I was producing my thing, which was... My thing was top secret, you see, really top secret. It had a code name on it. The training department was still top secret, but not top secret. So I could go to them for information, but they couldn't come to me for information.
The other interesting thing that you said is that at the time, because I know people weren't aware of it, generally, or commonly, it wasn't commonly known for a number of years, the Russians were actually commanding Chinese squadrons.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, the Russians were running the whole thing, more or less.
What were the capabilities of the Russian pilots?
The Russians were very good.
And they would.
It wasn't until the Sabres came in that the Russians were having a field day for a while out there.
And were you getting information about the characteristics of the MiG-15s at that point, or what type of aircraft it was?
That didn't come my way at all. No, none of that came my way. But that would have been fed into somewhere in the system. But as I say, in I mean, for you know, take a, you know, this weapons of mass destruction. Now then, take these three groups that I talked about, which played a big part while I was there, in sort of because we couldn't understand it at all. But in the end, it turned out, you know, there's possible, probably, or firm sort of thing. we could firmly state, once that third number came up, what the Chinese Air Force expansion was going to be, virtually. And, you can go positive on something, you see. And it's when to go firm on a thing, or whether, you know, it's a bit like this. But I enjoyed it immensely,
It sounds very much that you built the whole thing quite a lot from scratch, as you said.
Well, the Chinese Air Force I'm talking about now, not the Russian Air Force, because there's a huge amount of people working on the Russian Air Force. But when they started coming in, Russian Air Force in the Far East started coming in the Korean War, then of course it came into the area that I was involved in. But I mean, in the office next door, which was the Russian Air Force in the West, which is always the critical one, that was the vital one, even though we had a war going, it was what was going to happen in Europe was the thing. I mean, I could go in there, because I cleared, but I mean, no one would tell me anything. Unless it was something, you know, very sort of particularly relevant.
Yeah. Would you hear of deployments maybe from the West to the East, or something of that order? Would you get that information?
Something like that would pass through.
And how accurate a picture do you think you could really build over that period of time?
But again, I'm talking about signal intelligence, the main thing, 100% signal intelligence. And taking the talented people they had then at GCHQ, which was a much smaller organisation than it is now. I mean, GCHQ was a collection of wooden sheds, virtually. Because you're going to sit down and talk to these people. And they had the translation out there, of Russian probably and Chinese. And you'd be trying to sort them out. They'd say, well, this fellow said, you know, so and so forth. And the reply was so and so forth. And so then it was up to us to interpret it into Air Force language sort of thing. Because they were not aviators, they couldn't. They could only tell you what information they had, and you had to interpret it.
Was the threat to Hong Kong perceived at that time at all?
Oh no, Hong Kong was just used as a good place to get information from.
But was there a threat from the Chinese Air Force?
No.
So there was no.
The nearest place was Canton. They were flying and flying their MiGs there and enjoying themselves, training and things like that.
So there was no deployment at all.
No thought of that. No.
I believe you also, after working at the Air Ministry, then went on to an all-weather meteor course.
Yes, I asked to go back on to flying duties, and I was sent on an all-weather flying course. The machines used were Meteors. I think they're Meteor 8s. And it was the most intensive flying spell I've had in my life. First of all, the idea was not just instruct you how to fly a Meteor, because, or get you up to date on flying back into practice, but was to fly in all weathers. And so the worse the weather was, the more the instructors liked it. Mark you, they were some of them were very, very talented. One or two of them killed themselves, which put you off a little. but they were quite remarkable. But so the idea was flying on instruments. So you did do other things. The thing was to use your instruments as much as possible. That's right. So there was a clouds around, you flew in the clouds. And you would then just fly on the basic instruments, not in the high top, just the basic sort of spirit level type instruments. And of course, you would fly at night. Possibly this will give you a better idea of the attitude. You take off at night, say 10 o'clock at night, not a moonlight night, just an ordinary pretty black night, probably quite a lot of cloud around, perhaps thick cloud. And you fly, and normally you would penetrate and get out the top of the cloud, depending on what height it was. And your instructor would start doing aerobatics. And then suddenly say to you, you have control. And of course, your instruments are toppling all over the place. You have no horizons. And you use the instruments that are functioning as best as you can to get the aircraft under control. And sometimes it was a bit of a task. Sometimes it, I think you stopped writing the instructor. He said, I've got control. He'd take it back. But and then you would do, obviously, night landings. But again, it was carried a stage further. You come in just using one engine on night landings. And then you would start up the other engine and just touch down and roll and take off. But remember, this was at night, not in daylight. You'd do all the things that you would have done in daylight. You'd do it in the dark or in bad weather. Engine failures, again, you do that in cloud at night. And they pushed you to your limits, I think, because I was saying on some occasions, I don't mean I started hyperventilating, but almost, you know, you sort of, because it was, it was very stressful. And I must say, particularly when we were flying on basic instruments at night, I used to find it quite stressful.
What was the ethos behind it? What were they trying to achieve with the all-weather course?
Well, just you see, at that time, you had got instrument ratings. And every pilot had to have an instrument rating test once a year. And I think the Air Force was looking ahead to sort of get this ability to fly and all kind of get it inbred. Possibly somewhere high up in the hierarchy, new instruments were coming along, new techniques were coming along, and they wanted the pilots so to be getting close to that ability. To be flying upside down at night is somewhat disconcerting if you've never done it before. Particularly if the instructor says to you, you take over.
And what were the types of instructors you had? You said they were very experienced. Were they
what? Well, they were obviously good, very good, very, very good pilots. Loved flying. I mean, they would have never done that job. They didn't love flying, quite honestly. I wouldn't have taken it on as a job if they'd asked me.